It's time for the Million Pound Radio Show, and here are your hosts, Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel.
Good evening, thank you very much. On tonight's show, our guests will be Bross, who will be performing two tracks from their new album live here in the studio. No, they won't. We just wanted to frighten you for a few minutes.
Front row have all gone grey.
Yeah. But yeah.
And we'll be examining the news that the hundreds of fearless, warrior-like Gurkhas who've been made redundant by the British Army have been signed up by Wimbledon Football Club.
But first, we're very honoured this evening to have in our audience a very special guest, none other than the Vice President of the United States of America, Mr. Dan Quayle.
Good evening, Mr. Vice President.
I must say, sir, your security arrangements are very, very interesting. I mean, wherever the President goes, there seems to be a huge motorcade, security agents, bodyguards everywhere, motorcycle outriders, hundreds and thousands of policemen, helicopters overhead, and you don't have any of those.
No, sir, just my personal bodyguard, Jake.
What, the old guy in the Marine uniform with the walk frame?
That's right. President Bush is very keen for me to create a low-profile, informal, accessible image.
Uh-huh. Mm. Now, looking at the rest of your itinerary, Beirut, Cuba, Nicaragua, Tehran, It'll just be you and Jake, will it?
That's correct.
And you don't feel worried at all?
Not at all. The President said to me before I left, "Rest assured," he said, "if anything happens to you in Beirut, 2-1 on, Cuba, 10-1, Tehran, evens, Nicaragua, 6-5, they'll feel the full weight of U.S. retribution."
What were all those numbers?
I wanted to ask the President that myself, but he'd already gone to the betting shop. But he did leave me this.
What, the fluorescent orange T-shirt with the bullseye on it?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I noticed Vietnam isn't on your itinerary, and of course, during the Vietnam War, you did your national service in the Indiana National Guard.
Correct.
There weren't many Viet Cong in Indiana in 1967, were there?
No, sir, we did a great job.
Well, Mr. Quayle, it's been very nice to have you on the show.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, listeners, tonight Nick and I feel especially honoured because we've been selected to host this week's programme justifying how the BBC works.
It's Your BBC, a programme designed to show you, the licensed bear, how your money is spent.
Well, I've whipped quickly through to the office of BBC Chairman Marmaduke Hussey. Good evening, Marmaduke.
Good evening.
Now, Marmaduke, we have been literally inundated by thousands of letters, all asking the same question, namely, where on earth did you get a name like Marmaduke?
Well, I was christened Marmaduke, actually, by my parents.
So your parents didn't like children, then?
On the contrary, they were very loving parents.
Oh, I see. What, they did it for a bet?
No, they didn't.
But they named you after the cat?
Well, if you must know, I think Marmaduke is quite a nice name, actually.
Well, I'll hand back to Andy, then, with the sobering thought that the BBC is being run by someone who thinks that Marmaduke is a nice name. Andy.
Well, I've beetled along to the BBC's radio phone-in studio to take calls from you, the listeners, about the programme so far. Mrs. Francis from Sydenham rang in to say she thought it was a good programme. But Mr. Spencer from Brighton rang to say he thought it was a bad programme. Mr. Cooper from Rugby says it's a good programme, while from Twickenham, Mrs. Tyler said it was a bad programme. And Mrs. Green from Doncaster says it's a very good programme. Mr. Bennett from Prestatyn thinks it's a very bad programme. So there we are. Over to you, Nick.
Well, Andy, I'm now at the rehearsal rooms where the BBC are auditioning actors for the hit TV comedy series Bread.
If you could just read the script from the top in your own time.
Hello, Mrs. Boswell. I'm your new rent officer and I've just popped round...
Hold it. I'm sorry, but the accent's wrong. This character's from Liverpool, you see?
But so am I. But my accent is a Liverpool accent.
Yes, but it's not a comedy Liverpool accent, is it? You know, full of extended vowels and swooping inflections. Show her, Tony.
Hello, Mrs. Boswell Whack. I'm your new rent officer, and I've just come across the Mersey.
You see?
But No one talks like that in Liverpool.
Well, of course not, but the viewers don't know that, do they?
What about the viewers in Liverpool?
Oh, don't be silly. No one in Liverpool watches Bread. Apparently they don't like being portrayed as cheerful but mentally backward social security scroungers. Sod the Scouser. The Southerners all love it. Next, please.
A fascinating insight there. Later on, we'll be sitting in on the auditions for Howard's Way, so that should be very interesting for all of you interested in cybernetics. First, Andy.
Well, Nick, now I'm with senior producer Desmond Bond, who's in charge of the internal BBC guidelines on violence. Now, Desmond, what depictions of violence are acceptable on the BBC?
Well, obviously it depends on the context. For instance, at this time of day on Radio 4, an average sort of punch like this one is quite acceptable for broadcast.
Right, so a medium-sized punch is okay.
Oh, yes, not a big punch, man, like this, but a medium one.
Right.
Like this.
So, right, I think we've dealt with punching there. What about weapons?
Well, in a nutshell, the guidelines say that a character hitting another character over the head, say, with a chair, is okay for broadcast.
You're not going to hit me with a chair.
Good Lord, no.
Oh, good.
But this shovel would be deemed excessive.
That's that's reassuring.
As would this sledgehammer. Now, the way the guidelines work. Mm-hmm. If a producer wants scenes of violence in his programme, then he just pays me a visit, and I demonstrate, as I have to you, exactly what would be acceptable. And funnily enough, since I've been in the job, there's been a lot less violence being broadcast at the BBC. Are you okay down there? Hello? Chap here. Oh, Sarah, call the BBC nurse again, will you?
Well, that's all from It's Your BBC. Andy and I have looked at the BBC management, its policies, its productions, and its first aid facilities. Remember, it's your BBC, so use it.
And now we move on to the interesting question of the privatisation of electricity. Now, with us in the studio tonight is the minister responsible, Cecil Parkinson. Now, Mr. Parkinson, just how is it all going to work?
Oh, you're going to interview me, are you?
Yes, why?
Well, it's just that I was given to understand on the phone that I'd be interviewed by a woman. Never mind.
Now, Mr. Parkinson, exactly how will this privatisation work?
She's nice.
Sorry?
That woman in the third row.
All right, yeah, if we could just concentrate on the privatisation of the electricity industry.
Sorry, of course, okay. Yes.
Now, of course, Mr. Parkinson, if you could stop waving at her for a second. Mr. Parkinson, okay? Now, a lot of critics
argue... Thought I recognised her.
Yes, I know.
I was worried I'd recognise her.
Yes.
Worried she'd recognise me.
Now, Mr. Parkinson, a lot of critics argue that what you're doing is basically just replacing one big monopoly with a regional monopoly.
My regional programme is going to force competition into the electricity industry. Let me explain. Say you're not happy with the electricity supplier in your region. Then all you have to do is simply place your house on the market, sell it, and then move house to a region where electricity is more competitively priced. It's as easy as that.
I see. Is selling your house and buying a new one the only choice?
No, not at all. You can keep your present house, take it down, brick by brick, and then rebuild it in an area with cheaper electricity. This is an exciting programme which will liberate the consumer. And if I may, I'd like to make one last very important point, namely that my phone number is 485-0513 and my wife goes out on Tuesdays.
Thank you, Mr. Cecil Parkinson, the Minister for...
Oh, Andy, if I could just...
Yes, right. Yes. I think you'll find there's a machine in the gentleman's toilet.
So much.
OK, well, later we'll be taking an in-depth look at Israeli Premier Yitzhak Shamir and asking, does Israel feel safe being governed by a ventriloquist doll?
And we'll be reviewing the revised Tory Party edition of the New Testament, retitled Jesus and the Disciples PLC Quarterly Bulletin, featuring Jesus driving the moneylenders into the temple. Ever since the dawn of time, man has felt the urge to create rhythms, melodies, and harmonies to enrich himself spiritually and generally annoy the neighbours, to experience the marvel that is music. When was music born? Anthropologists are now confident that music was invented in prehistoric times during a confrontation between two club-wielding cavemen. Cracking each other's skulls with bits of wood may well have been the start of percussion, but melody did not arrive until man created wind instruments. In ancient Greece, around 500 BC, a craftsman invented the bagpipes. And was put to death in the hope that the secret would die with him. But it was the invention of stringed instruments that liberated man musically. The violin is thought to have been invented in medieval Italy.
At last, it is perfected. The violin.
How you play it?
You simply take this bow, thus, and draw it across this bit of sheep gut. Perhaps I should have taken it out of the sheep first.
But of course, the most magical instrument of all is the human voice. And the first professional singers were the troubadours and minstrels who accompanied the Crusades, singing their own songs. This song is thought to have belonged to Gerard of Bute.
Oh, Richard, lion-hearted king, went away to the east to fight an infidel called Saladin. But the infidel did well, gave King Dickie merry hell. He got his face smashed in, got his face smashed in.
More key changes in that short verse than the Tower of London has seen in the last 2,000 years. There are no written records of these songs, thank God. But they are passed on through the oral tradition, just like folk songs. People often wonder why folk singers stick their finger in their ears. This dates back to medieval times when, if folk singers didn't block their ears, people tried to pour poison into them. But perhaps the ultimate expression of man's musical soul can be found in opera. Opera is an astonishing medium where characters sing the same line over and over again so that the Americans in the audience don't lose track of the plot. Opera is enriching, uplifting, as is the musical, though the musical can pose severe artistic challenges in the rehearsal stage.
So anyway, my Macbeth to make
Okay. So, look, this is one of the most moving parts of The Sound of Music, so let's run it without the band. Yep. The Germans are pursuing the family, and Captain Von Trapp steps forward, sings this lovely ballad. So, from the top, Dominic.
Okay.
Edelweiss, Edelweiss, every Malcolm. This doesn't feel right. I don't understand my motivation here at all. I mean, why am I singing this?
Well, it's a patriotic ballad. It sums up the love you have for your native Austria.
I see, which is now occupied by the Germans who are after me and my family, is that
right? Well, that's right, yes.
Yes. Malcolm, I hate to be picky, but in my opinion, when you're being chased by the Nazis, you don't stop to sing a slow ballad about a small alpine flower. I don't actually think you'd sing anything, actually. Not unless it was something like, "For God's sake, run, here come the Nazis."
Yes, thank you, Dominic, for your input.
And why do they hang about while that nun belts out 8 verses of Climb Every Mountain? That's suicide, isn't it?
All right. I think I've solved this little creative problem.
Oh, good.
We'll do Oklahoma instead.
What?
We'll change the set. The cause is we've got 8 weeks to our opening night. No prob. Okay, let's rehearse. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Right, Dominic. You're an Oklahoma farmer,
gotcha,
surveying the beauty of the sun-drenched prairie, mm-hmm, which fills you with joy so that you burst into song. So, in your own time.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden...
How come I know the words?
Sorry, Dominic.
Well, it's not a traditional song, is it? It's original. So how come I, an Oklahoma farmer, know the words and the tune and can sing it straight off just like that? I mean, it's illogical. Unless my character wrote the song in the bath or something.
Well, that's it, Dominic. He wrote it in the bath.
Oh, I see. Right, so you're saying that he's a composer of some musical talent then?
Oh, correct.
Then why is he flogging his guts out on a farm in Oklahoma? mean, it's just not realistic, is it?
Look! There is no realism in musicals. It's a world populated by naive, mental retards who go around singing about everything they're feeling at the time and who, somehow, psychically perhaps, know the words and the tunes to songs that in theory they've not heard before and who are also surrounded by lots of other people who must also be psychically gifted because they all bloody well join in. Got it?
Well, my point exactly. It's absurd. I just can't see the creative justification for rehashing these old musicals.
Yes, I think Dominic's got a very good point.
The creative justification is that they attract thousands of coachloads of retired folk and tourists who pack out the theatre, thus ensuring that we all have 18 months paid, secure employment.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow.
While new musicals continue to flop, the old classic musicals live on. Great shows like The Sound of Music, South Pacific, and Seven Brides for Three Bigamists, which had to be rewritten to appease the moral majority in America. And then in the 50s came rock and roll, inspired by giants like Elvis, Little Richard, and Buddy Holly. Mick Jagger explains.
Now, I think, you know, for all touring rock musicians, you know, I think Buddy Holly was, you know, an amazing influence. I mean, he brought in so many innovations, but most notably, the tour bus. Because, like, somehow after Buddy, you know, everyone wanted to travel by road.
The 60s brought the Beatles, the Stones and psychedelia. Rock survivors Stig Prowse and Greg Stone remember the impact of psychedelia.
Well, like the Maharishi would tell us, he'd say, yeah. You don't need all that money,
no,
man.
You don't need
that checkbook. Throw them away.
Yeah, so we did.
Yeah.
We threw them.
And then he'd giggle.
Yeah. And then he'd pick them up, wouldn't he? And put them in his pocket. Yeah. And he giggled some more.
Yeah, giggled a lot, didn't he, the Maharishi?
He was a giggler.
One of life's gigglers, yeah.
Then came the 70s when Johnny Rotten created punk, primarily as a way of keeping his nasal passages free of catarrh. What do Greg and Stig remember about the 70s?
I remember a great big mirror.
Yeah. With a big pile of white powder on it.
Yeah. Next thing I knew, it was 1987. Yeah.
So where will music go next? Hitmakers Stock, Aiken and Waterman.
Well, music's heading away from complex, sophisticated songs with clever lyrics, you know, like those of Kylie Minogue or Mel and Kim.
Right, I mean, using computer technology, we're headed for something much more dynamic, more primal.
Yeah, this will be the sound of 1990.
And so man's adventure with sound continues as he grapples with the marvel that is...
Turn the crap off, someone, for God's sake!
Hey, Nick, have you noticed there's a lot more tourists in London this
year? Yeah, you can always tell them, can't you?
Yeah, they're the ones at bus stops actually reading the timetable. Mind you, the tubes are just as bad. The other night, I got my ticket at Victoria and then the press gang got me.
What press gang?
You know, that press gang that grab you and force you to use those new automatic ticket barriers, that one.
Oh, them, right, yeah. You know, I reckon those barriers aren't safe, you know. I mean, what if there's a fire? People can die.
No, Nick. The station manager explained it all to me. Yeah. Only the people without tickets will die.
Oh.
It's a new way of discouraging fare dodging.
Right.
Anyway, I'm standing on the platform, no trains, and sure enough...
Good evening, this is District Line Information Control with details on how the service is running tonight as part of LRT's programme to keep you, the passenger, totally informed at all times. For those of you waiting for an Upminster train, I can tell you that one is just leaving Earl's Court Station. You can see it on my video monitor. There it goes, pulling out of the station... Clickety-clack, clickety-clack. And into the tunnel. It's a silver-coloured train being driven by Ralph Oates, who's wearing a pullover his mum knitted him for Christmas. More information. information from London Regional Transport, there is an economic crisis in Afghanistan. You may possibly have known that, but as I say, we like to keep you totally informed.
Blimey, how long did he keep that up for?
Well, not that long. Some passengers formed a lynch mob, hunted him down and strung him up from the indicator board.
Lynched him? Well, why didn't you do anything?
Well, they seem to be managing perfectly okay, aren't they? Anyway, my train arrived, so I got on.
Crowded?
Yeah, as usual. Packed with people shaking their heads and talking to themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. I found myself stuck between a man shouting Antichrist into his duffel bag, a woman talking to an invisible hippo, and worst of all, four burly drug addicts covered in death's head tattoos.
I tell you, the sooner we get those guardian angels on the tube...
These were guardian angels. Then an inspector started working his way through the carriage, so I showed him a ticket.
I'm afraid I shall have to take your name, sir, for breaking the London Regional Transport bylaws.
Well, what? My ticket's in order, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Well, then what am I doing wrong?
Well, the thing is, you're not talking to yourself, are you? You see, you look at this carriage, every single passenger is talking to himself in a vaguely psychotic way. Except you.
Well, I don't want to talk to myself.
You have to. It's compulsory. The new regulations say all passengers to display signs of dementia.
This is absurd. So you're telling me that only nutters are allowed to travel on the tube?
Only nutters want to travel on the tube.
Then I must be a nutter then.
Ah, so you hit him with the old catch-22.
That's
nice,
right,
one,
yeah.
The inspector was sane though, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he was very calm and rational, you know. You should have heard him politely telling the invisible hippo his season ticket expired, you know.
And now, continuing our series looking at the home lives of interesting people with rewarding jobs, this week, at home with a tabloid journalist.
I'm home, love.
Oh. Hello, love. Had a good day?
Yeah, not bad. The editor asked me to do tomorrow's front page story, you know? It's all about that travel courier girl who got murdered. I've done the whole of tomorrow's front page, covering all the key factual details about the murder, like the fact that she had more than one boyfriend. A freewheeling lifestyle and wore tight jeans, you know.
Well, she was asking to be murdered then, wasn't she, really?
Yeah. It's a great piece I've done, love. The only thing that's missing, really, is a good quote from the parents.
Shame.
Yeah, I tried to get a quote from them on whether their dead daughter used to put it about a bit, but they just didn't want to talk to me, either. Can't think why. Just kept asking me to be quiet as I was interrupting the funeral service. Anyway, then I went for lunch.
What did you have?
Oh, the usual. 16 pints, then back to the office for a quick vomit over the secretaries. Then I made up a story about a left-wing council banning the book Black Beauty as racist. Thought up 20 things no one knows about Cliff Richard. Groped a couple of the temps and then wrote a piece on declining moral standards.
Good for you, love.
Well, it needs saying, doesn't it, love? I was rather pleased with it, actually, especially the stuff about rapists. Yeah. Bung these bonkers behind bars.
Oh, that's very good.
Yeah, I'm about to come home, and guess what? Remember that vicar?
Oh, what? The one you said had AIDS?
Get your facts right, love. I never said he had AIDS. I used the phrase a mystery illness and put inverted commas each side of it, remember?
Oh, yes, 16 inverted commas each side, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. His brother rang me. Apparently, that vicar, he read my piece and he went out and killed himself last night.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah, very sad. Yeah, I was just too late for the morning edition. Anyway, the puffy priest brother was very decent about it all. Very, very concerned about me, he was.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah. All he kept asking me was how I slept at night.
Next week, at home with William Rees-Mogg, who likes to spend his evenings watching his favourite TV show, Allo, Allo, and then ruling on questions of public taste.
Actually, we've been asked to point out that there was, in fact, a serious factual error in that piece about a tabloid journalist, namely that no tabloid journalist is ever sober enough to make it home.
And now...
Walt Disney presents Snow White and the Seven Dwarves.
This story so far. Snow White is lost in the Enchanted Woods when she happens upon the cottage belonging to the Seven Dwarves.
My, my, what a pretty cottage. But it's so untidy inside. I know, I'll tidy it up, and maybe whoever lives here will let me stay and shelter from the wicked queen.
And so Snow White tidied and scrubbed and dusted the cottage till it was spick and span, and she worked so hard she fell asleep and didn't hear the seven dwarves coming home.
I'm home, I'm home.
Why, who's this?
Oh, I'm Snow White. Who are you?
We're the seven dwarves. I'm happy.
I'm grumpy.
I'm bashful.
I'm dopey.
I'm sneezy.
I'm sleepy.
And I'm stroppy.
Stroppy?
You heard me.
I didn't know there was a dwarf called Stroppy.
Well, you do now.
What happened to Doc?
Got struck off.
My, 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 look at our cottage. It's all bright and clean. Who did that?
I did. I let myself in and I wiped and I dusted till it was all gleaming clean.
Did you now?
Yes.
How can we repay you, Snow White?
Well, you could let me shelter here from the wicked queen.
Bollocks. Go sponge off someone else.
Ignore, Stroppy. Of course you can stay.
Oh, I see. I'm the invisible dwarf now then, am I?
You can stay forever and ever.
Yeah, actually, our lease does say we can't sublet.
You can stay because we all like you.
I'm gonna vomit.
I like you, Snow White. I think you're beautiful.
Thank you, Dopey. You see, Stroppy, Dopey likes me.
He's a mental retard. He likes everyone. He married the kettle last week.
Don't you worry, Snow White. We'll shelter you from the wicked queen.
We sure will. Well, Stroppy?
I'm a reasonable dwarf. I'm happy to abide by the majority decision and let Snow White shelter in our cottage.
Good for you, Stroppy.
Well done, Stroppy. Well done, that's Stroppy. A very well said thing.
Of course, she'll probably sing songs all day, won't you, Snow White?
Oh, yes, I love singing.
Yes, you'll enjoy that, won't you, Grumpy?
Mm.
And, of course, she'll be doing a lot of cleaning.
Oh, yes, I'll clean all day long.
Lots of banging and crashing to look forward to, eh, Sleepy? And I expect she'll confiscate your amphetamines, Happy.
Amphetamines? Oh, we can't have drugs in the cottage.
Oh, no, we can't have drugs in the cottage,
so no more cocaine for you, Sneezy. She'll patronise you to death, Dopey. And as for you, Bashful, she'll probably send you for assertion therapy. But these are minor quibbles on my part. You boys must make up your own minds about letting her stay.
Throw her out, you bloody dugout! Get rid of that Snow White.
And so Snow White was booted out of the cottage into the enchanted wood, where the wicked queen found her and shot her.
That's it for this week. Next week, we'll be reviewing Martin Scorsese's latest controversial film about religion. It's called The Creation, and it shows God holding planet Earth saying, and here's one I did earlier.
And we'll also be meeting the magician who can convert a gallon of half-treated sewage into a gallon of drinking water just by privatizing it. Thank you very much, and good night.
Good night.
The Million Pound Radio Show was written and presented by Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel and featured Leslie Sharp and Jasper Jacobs. It was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.